This is Talking Drupal, a weekly chat about web design and development from a group of people with one thing in common. We love Drupal. This is episode 498, DOJ Accessibility Ruling. On today's show, we're talking about accessibility, the Department of Justice, and what it means for Drupal with our guest, Josh Mitchell. We'll also cover Sally as our module of the week. Welcome to Talking Drupal. Today, our guest is Josh Mitchell. Josh has led teams in digital agencies, governments, educational institutions, and nonprofits, including some time as the CTO of the Drupal Association. He's currently the founder and principal consultant of M6L. As a full-stack consultant, he's as comfortable advising leadership teams as fulfilling a range of roles on teams developing ambitious web platforms. Josh, welcome back to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me back.
I'm John Picozzi, Solutions Architect at EPAM, and today my co-hosts are joining us for the third week, Kathy Beck, Senior UX Engineer at Oomph.
Hello.
And last but certainly not least, Nick Laughlin, Founder at Enlightened Development.
Good morning. Happy to be here. And yes, John, I know it's not morning where everybody's listening.
Well, it's fine. It could be afternoon or somebody could be listening to this at night. Like, you know, I tend to put people to sleep. So
it's perfect. Or Martin.
Perfect. Okay. Well, where is Martin? Martin is in Belgium right now. Is that accurate?
That's correct. At Drupal Dev Days.
All right. Well, that's fabulous. And now to talk about our module of the week, let's turn it over to Martin Anderson Klutz, a senior solutions engineer at Acquia and a maintainer of a number of Drupal modules and recipes of his own. Martin, what do you have for us this week?
Thanks, John. Have you ever wanted your Drupal site to have a built-in accessibility tool that could identify things like potential color contrast issues? There's a module for that. It's called Sally, and it's worth mentioning that the name is a numeronym, so spelled S-A-1-1-Y, which plays off of a common way the word accessibility is abbreviated. The module was created in January of 2018 by Brian Sharp, but the namespace was taken over in June of 2024 by Mark Conroy of LocalGov Drupal, so the current 3.0.1 release, which supports Drupal 10 and 11, is a completely different module than the original 8.x-1.x branch. Module is actively maintained. In fact, this module came out of the ongoing work being done on the LocalGov distribution and profile. It does have security coverage and does not have a test coverage, but the module is effectively just a wrapper for the Sally library, which is CMS agnostic and used in the WordPress and Joomla communities as well. The Sally library has its own website, which does include documentation. And the module has one open issue, which is not a bug. So that's pretty good considering the module is officially in use by 62 sites, according to Drupal.org. Now, we did cover the editorially accessibility checker as module of the week all the way back in episode number 350, almost 3 years ago. And Sally was mentioned at that time. Both modules have had major releases since then. So I thought this week's episode would be a good chance to do an updated comparison. Sally does include some checks that editorially does not, such as color contrast checking and a readability score. The editorially module, on the other hand, includes site-wide reporting that would be helpful for site admins, as well as a wealth of configuration options, including one or more DOM elements to use as the container to check within, a list of elements to exclude, and so on. Recent versions of editorially also include an option for live feedback as you edit, which should work with CK Editor 5, Paragraphs 5 or newer, and Gutenberg. At the end of the cover, both projects are intended to provide your content editors with immediate feedback on the accessibility compliance of what they create. So it's worth looking at the feedback each tool provides and deciding which one is more useful for your team in particular. So let's talk about Sally.
I love a module that just, the name just flows off the tongue like that. Like, because I feel like, what do we know what the S stands for in Sally?
I mean, I'm not sure that the S is an abbreviation, but
I mean, probably simple.
Simple accessibility.
Right. Like I'm just totally guessing here, but Martin, let's go back to the beginning of when you started talking about Sally. What is Sally?
Sally is a module, Drupal module.
No. I don't mean like what does it do? I mean like the word Sally. What part of speech is it? Like what?
Numeronym.
A numeronym. Wow.
Right.
Okay.
So it's, I mean, you'll see the same thing with Kubernetes where people write as K8S or internationalization as I18N. It's really just sort of a geeky way of abbreviating very long words so that they're easier to type in conversation.
I mean, I think that's the first time I've heard that used, that word used. So that's pretty cool. I mean, I think this module, like, I don't know, any module that makes accessibility easier to me feels great. Has anybody on the call used Sally before?
Not yet.
I tested it out in its early iteration before this new maintainer took over. So I think it's worth taking another shot. An S does stand for straightforward or simple, conveying the idea of straightforward accessibility.
Good to know.
Good call, John.
Interesting. Hey, sometimes I know things.
I think it's interesting that it's got so much overlap with editorially. You know, it's cool that they're working in concert to try to, you know, pull over features from each other. I wonder if someday that there might be a chance that they could be merged in some way. So they are using different underlying library. So
apparently the editorially library that the module is based on is actually a fork of the Sally library. And where the editorially library is largely maintained by the team at Princeton, I believe it's a college in Toronto, Canada, that is actually doing the ongoing work on Sally. And so apparently the two teams do collaborate and sort of communicate somewhat, but, you know, each of them has sort of different priorities in terms of where they think they, you know, their individual products need to evolve. I do also think maybe down the road, it's possible we might see in the Drupal ecosystem something that could be library agnostic, so that maybe for certain content types you would want to use one tool, or maybe for certain editors or you know, by role, you could you know, sort of use a combination of the two for different kinds of tasks as well. I think that would be pretty cool if somebody wanted to create that.
To add to that, there is a small snippet on the editorially page that says that it's developed in parallel with Sally and that they test a lot of similar things, but editorially is more focused on minimizing the GUI, and Sally has some expanded capability around color checking and that kind of thing. So sounds like they collaborate and they kind of solve similar spaces. But if you want something more comprehensive, Sally might be the way to go.
Feels to me like, Martin, there could be like a Talking Drupal Module of the Week exclusive where you like compare both of them and then like point out interesting features of each. But, you know, nobody here needs more work.
It is.
We're just looking at doing a custom check, because I've actually written a custom check for editorially before that looks for phone numbers and makes sure that they're properly formatted as a link. Huh. And asks editors, hey, make sure this isn't a fax number, because you don't want to click to call on a fax number, as an example. it's a really cool one. I would contribute it back, but it's very specific to, like, I went so custom on it that I check for Oregon area codes even. So it's very, very specific. In the particular example, it's for a local government. So, but I was just looking at the Sally website, and writing the custom checks is just basically identical. Yeah, instead of writing editorially as your overall function, you write Sally. But the structure of it is exactly the same. So my guess is there's a lot of overlap between the two. It'd just be figuring out which one works best for your use case.
Yeah, and even when I mentioned earlier about how the editorially module has some additional configuration options, the Sally library has those same configuration options. It's just that the Drupal module doesn't expose those as sort of configuration options. So it's possible that a future version of those could certainly add that.
I like how Josh insinuated that maybe our listeners don't want to just listen to the docile tones of a fax machine, like through their telephone headset. I mean, come on, who doesn't like to like just hear like, you know?
Someone could have that as old music, maybe.
Yeah. Old music, that's a great idea. All right. Well, Martin, as always, thank you for bringing us another very on-topic module of the week. If folks wanted to suggest a module or just chat about modules in general, how could they go about doing that?
We are always happy to talk about interesting modules in the Talking Drupal channel of Drupal Slack, or folks can reach out to me directly as ManClue on all of the Drupal and social channels.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot.
See you next week.
See you next week.
Bye. Have fun at Dev Days.
Hey, Talking Drupal listeners, MidCamp is happening on May 20th. Here's more info from the team that's organizing it.
Get ready for MidCamp 2025, happening May 20th to the 22nd in Chicago, Illinois.
At MidCamp, we're dedicated to creating an inclusive and accessible event for everyone passionate about Drupal.
Our pricing model is designed to welcome all, from seasoned professionals to newcomers eager to learn.
Whether you're a developer, designer, or site builder, MidCamp is your chance to connect, learn, and grow within the Drupal community. We accept marketers, too.
This year, we're bringing you 25 sessions along with hands-on trainings, a fireside chat with Drupal founder Dries Bytart, and plenty of networking opportunities.
Visit midcamp.org to register today. Tickets start at just $25, and scholarships are available, too.
Join us at MidCamp 2025, where the Drupal community comes together.
All right, MidCamp, that's going to be a good time. I know that I believe Martin is going to be there. So if you see him, say hi. And let's move on to our primary topic. All right. So for this episode, we are talking about the DOJ accessibility ruling. The DOJ, for those that may not know, is the Department of Justice in the United States. So, Josh, let's level set here, right? Like, not everybody, including myself, may not know really about this accessibility ruling and what it entails. So can you give us kind of like a high-ish level overview of what the accessibility rule entails?
Yeah, you bet. So the U.S. Department of Justice basically outlined that state and local governments and special jurisdictions all need to have web content and mobile apps that are compliant with the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, the WCAG, version 2.1 AA. And if you're familiar with those guidelines, the WCAG, I believe the latest version is actually 2.2, but it's not like widely adopted yet as compliant, or like a compliance rule, if you will. And you can go up to AAA, though there are some exceptions of actually being able to achieve AAA. Like, if you ever try to match AAA for, like, say, link color contrast, you can't do it with color blue. It's not even possible. You can only get to AA because if you get it dark enough that it's high enough contrast against the light background, then it will be too dark for being next to black text, as an example. So there's a I think 2.1 AA is a good solid level to shoot for because it's loose enough that I think governments can get to it, but strict enough that it really helps make the web better for everybody.
And does this apply to all federal websites, to local government? Like, how does this ruling affect websites in general?
That's a great question. It's actually not even aimed at federal websites. Federal websites have actually been required to be accessible since 1998. So if you go to section 508.gov, which refers to section 508 of the Americans for Disability Act, it basically government websites have needed to hit a standard for a very long time. Now, I don't think they actually moved to using the WCAG 2.0 in like 2017. In terms of what the federal guidelines were. But this ruling is specifically aimed not at government websites, which already had to meet these guidelines, but at state and local jurisdictions. So if you're looking at any of the 50 states, county websites, city websites, that sort of thing. And so, actually, if you really want to dive, like all the way down to public schools, police departments, technically public hospitals and healthcare clinics, public libraries, public transit agencies, it's pretty broad in terms of what it covers down at the local level. It's really meant to try to get everything that is a public service up to an accessibility standard.
So I have a gotcha that I'm wondering about, and you may or may not be able to answer this, but I'm going to throw it at you and see what you come back with. So in Rhode Island, right, the Rhode Island, transit authority, or not the transit authority, but the organization that runs buses in the state of Rhode Island, right, is not a government agency, right? It's not part of the kind of local government. It's like a private company that gets a lot of government funding, right? Would this apply to them?
So it depends. There is, in the ruling, there is a definition of what's called a special district government, which means a public entity that can be other than a county or municipality, township, independent school district, what have you, that is authorized by state or local law to provide a function or a limited number of designated functions with enough fiscal autonomy to qualify as a government. So it's broad enough that my guess is that would be covered unless that's truly a private entity. But if it has a public aspect to it and it's being funded by public dollars and then they're providing the service, my guess is somebody's going to make the legal challenge to say that they would be covered. Yeah. For instance, we have TriMet in the Portland area, very similar, right. But that TriMet is the only authorized public transit provider. So they are essentially a extra governmental organization, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like the same thing. So that was definitely a great answer. Thank you.
Are there provisions to update the target? Because you said they're currently targeting 2.1. They previously targeted 2.0 8 years ago. Are there provisions in this to like update it to 2.2 in another 5 years and whatever the current version is? Or is it kind of like a lot of other things where like they just have to evaluate it every 10 years and make a decision?
Yeah, in this particular case, basically what would trigger it would be a outside group pushing for the DOJ to update their ruling. So it could be some, accessibility experts within the DOJ. It could be some particular legal rulings that actually push the standard to update. I will say that 2.1 is it's pretty thorough. 2.2 is actually covering some things that aren't even completely implemented by every browser. So 2.1 is more than adequate for the moment that we're in terms of kind of pushing people to go to that. I think that'll stand up for easily another 5 to 10 years before that would get changed from a ruling standpoint. And they have the means to amend these. They are rulings. They are meant to guide legal decisions. So,
okay. When does this rule go into effect?
It's already in effect. It went into effect in April of 2024. And what it means whenever something goes into effect is basically this ruling is now applicable to all of these sites. And your compliance dates are now this date into the future. So while the ruling is already in effect, the compliance requirements are actually based on the size of the organization by population as to when they have to be done by. And this is kind of a fascinating thing to me, because what it comes down to is if you are a state or local government of more than 50,000 people, you need to be compliant with this ruling by April 24th, 2026. So a big part of why I wanted to come in April and talk about this is because time's a ticking, right? We've got literally 1 year for sites of jurisdictions of 50,000 or more. That's a lot of jurisdictions. That's pretty much most jurisdictions across the United States, if we're looking at total numbers. And it's, you know, if it's a smaller jurisdiction or if it's one of those special district governments, because the special district government, they're basically saying it's hard to say that it's a 50,000 or more. So we're basically going to give it a slightly different date. But for both of those smaller situations, so 50,000 or less than 50,000, April 26th, 2027. So 2 years.
So 2 years.
So, yeah.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did I understand you correctly? Are you saying if you have less people, you get more time?
Yes. Exactly. And the reason for that is because there's an assumption that a smaller jurisdiction has less control over their technologies, right? They have a smaller technology stack, but it's like Earl sitting in the back room managing the website. It's not like as big of a team.
Well, I think it's actually probably two separate parts, actually. I would think, number one, there's less resources for them to update, which is related to what you were just saying, Josh. But I also think it's fewer people impacted by it as well. So with those two factors mitigating, I think it's like it's okay for it to take an extra year to give them time to update and also people to get what they need for organizations or governments that are 50,000 or more. It's impacting far more people far more frequently, and they generally have the resources to dedicate to something like this. So I think that timing makes sense. It's interesting that that's built in too, that was considered.
I mean, that all makes like sense to me, I guess. But I mean, one of my big questions here, I guess, is, and something that I don't know that we necessarily talked about, but like, I don't know, say somebody doesn't comply. What are the penalties here? Are they financial? Are they like, hey, we're going to like shut your website off? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, the ruling can't actually provide that information, or at least they chose not to say here are specific penalties. The ruling basically says you must be compliant by this time, but it doesn't really give a strong sense of what the penalty would be. In practice, what we've seen with previous rulings like this is it opens up that jurisdiction to private lawsuits because they're not meeting a government requirement, right? So you have, you know, increased risk, much broader, I don't want to say attack service, but, you know, it's risk. It's
liability.
It's people who might come and say, hey, this isn't what you're supposed to do. I compare it to, there was a ruling in the city of Portland area not that long ago, within the last 10 years, that was related to crosswalk ramps. And they basically sued the city of Portland, and then all of the penalties and whatnot got put into writing of you have to do it by these dates or there will be the following penalties back to this group. And so, you know, over the last 5 years, seeing crosswalks torn up to get the new accessible ramps built into them is really, really common in the city of Portland. And they've had to prioritize. They're like, you know, you can't do them all the same day because you just don't have enough contractors to do everything. So you tend to do it in order of highest priority, highest traffic, that sort of thing. So,
reasonable kind of like requirements and then penalties if you don't meet those requirements, basically.
Exactly. And there could be penalties. More likely it would be because it's a federal ruling being applied to state and local jurisdictions, rather than it being, okay, we're going to charge state and local jurisdictions this much. More likely what you would see is the withholding of funds for failure to be compliant. So it would be a case where, which, I mean, right now, state and local governments are already under so much stress as it relates to having funds removed or withheld. So it's another potential space where we could see even more stress put on state and local governments.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to me that the DOJ creates this ruling and kind of like puts these things into motion, right? But then they kind of let the private sector suss out the offenders and the folks that may not be upholding these sorts of things. And you know, I think we've all, you know, we all hearken back to the Target lawsuit and the Domino's lawsuit and all the lawsuits that revolve around accessibility and the fact that, you know, folks have found issues, but they also are able to hold people accountable, which I think this is kind of in the same vein. Like, nobody wants to go to their local or city website and not be able to use it because of accessibility issues.
And this is something that comes up on almost any episode that we talk about accessibility, but there's benefits beyond kind of what's on its face for accessibility, right? If your site is more accessible, it's easier to use for everybody, which means that there's going to be fewer support calls. There's going to be fewer, there's going to be less, resources taken up on it. You know, it does take more effort sometimes on the design development side to retrofit a site, but if you kind of make this the mandate from the beginning, it's generally not a huge burden to add, and it makes your site so much nicer for everybody and makes it more functional. And that's something anybody should want, right? You don't want that frustration, you don't want that speaking of governmental sites, this always reminds me, the other day I had to check, I think I had to check the deed or something for my goodness, the website for checking your deed is so old. I think it was built in like 1992. And they were an early adopter, obviously, because there weren't very many things on the web at that point. But I don't think they've updated it since.
Well, go ahead, Kathy, go ahead.
I was going to say, but the thing is, a web from like 1992 might be slightly more accessible than a website built 2 years ago. Well, if you're trying to go back to basic markup and basic HTML, it should be ingested into everything correctly and be accessible to everyone.
I think it's interesting that, yeah, that could be the case, Kathy, but you also look at the disproportionate systems between different municipalities, right? So like some systems, if you've ever looked up, Nick talked about deeds, but if you've ever looked up like a plot map, right? If you've ever looked at buying real estate and you've wondered what the plot map looks like. Some municipalities use GIS, which is like a system that provides you with like an interactive map for that. Other municipalities literally have a list of PDFs on their website of all the different plots and like their scans of the maps that are on file somewhere, right? So, I mean, I think like when you think about this, right, you look at it and you go, okay, well, you know, if it's a system like GIS, it might be easier to make that more unilaterally, right, for the users of that, versus like, okay, now how do I make my PDFs more accessible, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. But
it's funny you mentioned the GIS thing, though, because it's not actually easier to get GIS to be accessible, especially for screen readers. I can remember vividly, I have some PTSD from this, but during the middle of COVID-19, height of the pandemic, the city of Portland needed to put out a list of accessible hand washing stations because, you know, they wanted people who are experiencing homelessness to be able to get to places and clean up so that they could try to reduce the spread of disease. And the GIS team kicked it off by getting the data about where these locations were. There'd be kind of a combination of a hand washing station and maybe a portable restroom, that sort of thing. The map that they put out, they immediately had somebody test with a screen reader, and this is using ArcGIS, which is a common standard for a lot of government agencies. And the number of keyboard traps built into that and the inability to kind of move through the set of addresses and say, oh, well, this is the one closest to me, meant that we ended up having to come up with a way to create a static web page that just listed all the locations and their addresses so that they could be kind of presented in an accessible fashion. Like it's hard to make maps accessible, extremely hard.
So let's dig into this a little bit more, right? And maybe not specifically with GIS, because I don't want to like pick on them. It's just, you know, something that I've come to know as something that certain municipalities use, right? But like two points here. One is a question, and one is, I guess, is a point. Is like, you know, my point previously was more that if a lot of municipalities are using one system, it's a lot easier to update one system and have like kind of check that box for all the municipalities than it is to say, go to 1,000 different websites and make changes, right? I don't think anybody here is disagreeing with that, right? But my question now is, how does this apply to those companies where municipalities use their services, right? So like, let's go back to our main topic here of the accessibility ruling. You know, the DOJ is saying, hey, your site has to be accessible. If part of your site is using a third-party service, does it now trickle down to that third-party service to say, hey, third-party service, you now need to take on the responsibility of being accessible because we're being held to that standard?
Yeah, this is where we get to talk about COTS and VPATs, because we all need acronyms, right?
Oh, yes. The VPAT.
More
right.
Acronyms.
VPAT, yeah. So I think the biggest risk surface area for governments is actually COTS, custom off-the-shelf software. This tends to be hosted and managed software provided by a third party. If you read through the ruling, if it is a government service being provided by that third party, even if it's not at a .gov address, or even if it's, you know, the example I always use is like GovQA. Lots of governments use GovQA as software to provide records lookup, because it has a neat little thing where you can publish recent records requests onto the website. You can make new records requests. The URL is a GovQA URL. It might have the name of the jurisdiction in it. You know, if the sub URL for that that jurisdiction's instance of GovQA, it will look typically like that jurisdiction's website. So it's been themed a little bit. I just went through really quickly and hit up three local GovQA sites that I know about, even a couple that had been touched within the last couple of years, so would be kind of aware of accessibility issues. In fact, I know for the city of Portland, they actually made a request to GovQA, please improve your accessibility, because it was so bad, their implementation of it. It was an older implementation, and they don't update it unless they have to, because this is managed service by a third-party organization, right? I can tell you, just running the Wave tool from WebAIM across those pages, the number of alerts and errors tell me it does not meet 2.1 AA accessibility, even though it's been touched in the last 2 years. And it's not just GovQA or ArcGIS. I could look at instances of, Granicus, if you're familiar with them. They've actually bought up a lot of products, but back in the mid-teens, 2010, 2011 range, they had this really cool agenda and meeting management software that would let you record video at the same time as marking up a Word document that became the official document of record for a board meeting or a council meeting, as an example. Really cool software. Incredibly difficult to make accessible. I mean, aside from their web search decisions, which include things like, I just looked at it earlier this week. It's still using layout tables for the search form above.
Do they have spacer GIFs?
I, you know what's funny is I did not test for that, but I bet they do. I mean, like you know, layout tables haven't been used since forever ago, right? 20 years ago, and we moved to CSS.
Also interesting of note, Granicus purchased GovQA. I don't know if you know that. So
I did not know that, but that's good to know, because I mean, honestly, it's this one big super org now that has all these contracts with all these different cities. And honestly, they're going to have all these cities telling them, hey, you have to be compliant. And they're going to say, well, we can't do it in time. I, As much as the ruling kind of highlights that it should be possible from a cost benefit analysis, I think the broad nature of their ruling isn't actually feasible. Like there's no way all of these COTS applications are going to get updated to match. Drupal sites are pretty close. Like most Drupal sites I know, you can get there pretty quickly. But when you look at these COTS applications, they're just not there. They often have a VPAT.
Well, hold on. Before we talk about VPATs, because that's a whole nother animal, right? What's the time frame for them on this, though? Do they have the 2 years, right? Or is it like collectively? Sorry, there's a it's floating in front of my face here.
Yeah, they have the same 2 years from last year's April effective date, right? So they're still looking at the deadline for larger organizations of next April, for smaller organizations of the year after. And I will say that the tools used by those smaller organizations are as bad, if not worse, whenever it comes to the products that they've bought and the managed hosting that they've set up. The number of Drupal 7 sites that are jurisdictions of 50,000 or below is actually pretty high, because they tend to be run through managed hosting services through companies like Civic Plus or a number of others that are out there that they went into business doing that small market website, and they didn't necessarily keep up, because you don't get rich selling to small counties and cities.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot again that bigger people that service bigger get less time, and people that service smaller get more time. Because I was like, 2 years, like a company should be able to update their platform in 2 years, right? But they only get 1 year, so that could be a tighter. Yeah.
They had 2 years from the beginning of the ruling. So
fair enough. But I mean, like, let's just look at the Drupal 7 upgrade, right? And the fact that, like, you know, people kind of wait as long as they possibly can. And when you're dealing with government, sometimes those things are associated with budget requirements and whatnot, which can also delay your ability to be as effective as you want to.
For sure. I think as we're looking at all these COTS apps, I mentioned VPATs. That's the voluntary product accessibility template, which is a way for a company to say, we tried to make this accessible. It's voluntary. It's not super precise. The VPAT doesn't have to meet 2.1 AA as an example. It can just say, here's the accessibility things we do. It doesn't have to say, these are the places we are not compliant. VPATs are good for procurement processes to make sure that the new software you're procuring, that the company has at least written something down about their accessibility stance. But they're not great for retroactive enforcement. So they don't really provide any teeth for getting a third party organization to be compliant.
Go ahead, Kathy. I was going to say, what about like accessibility, the ACRs, or even just an accessibility statement on your website? Are they any different than the VPAT? They equally significant in the eyes of the law?
So very similarly, like your accessibility statement is not going to be the determining factor of compliance. The fact that you say you're accessible, it's the same as a privacy statement, right? We can say, hey, we're taking care of your data. But if you are audited and you're found to not be taking care of the data, there may be a requirement that you update your statement in some way to say, hey, we're short on this. But I can tell you, most of these government organizations, they're not going back to those accessibility policies listed on their website or their privacy policies and updating those on even a yearly basis. It tends to happen when there is a major redesign, and then it's forgotten about.
So I was once told, and you can voice your opinion on this statement. I don't want to call a VPAT like a get out of jail free card, because it's definitely not that, right? But I was told once that if your VPAT has, you know, known issues or issues that you know you're working on, right, as far as accessibility items go, that can go a long way in if you were to be sued, to say like, that you're working on them and you're working towards a resolution, but there isn't an immediate fix available right now. Is that a fair assessment of how a VPAC could be used?
I think it would definitely, it would provide a little bit of intent. Hey, we're trying to be better.
Right.
Which I think will be important in this ruling. But I can tell you in the other accessibility lawsuits that have gone on out there, intent without action doesn't equal get out of jail. To be able to ignore the compliance isn't going to be an option.
If you throw up a VPAT and 6 months later there's been zero progress, then that's more culpable because you know there's an issue and you're not working towards it. Now, if you can prove, if you can prove in court, if there's a lawsuit that, hey, yeah, we dedicate 30% of our time, 50% of our time each week to this, it's just that hard that it's going to take us a year of doing that. Well, yeah, that's probably a mitigating factor. If you put that up and you say, yes, we prioritize it, and then they show that your developers have spent 1 hour in the last 6 months on it. Well, right.
So, I mean, it's more of like, hey, we know this issue exists and we're working to fix it. Or, hey, we know this issue exists and the fix for it would be like financially detrimental to us. Like, that's why we haven't fixed it. I don't know if that's a defense there, but I mean, I would imagine there's some validity to that defense. Now, before we continue, I would like to inform our listeners, to the best of my knowledge, none of us are lawyers, and you should not take anything that we're saying as legal advice. Please consult an actual lawyer if you have legal questions or need their advice.
Not a lawyer, but I play one on podcasts.
Exactly.
So bringing it back to Drupal, how is Drupal positioned to assist organizations, either if they're already on Drupal or the platform that they're on just isn't going to be feasible? How is Drupal positioned to assist with this ruling?
As with a lot of this, I'm going to say it depends. If we're talking about Drupal core and just what's included in Drupal core, we as a community have a real commitment to accessibility. There are accessibility gates for any new features that come into Drupal core that require that user interface to have some testing. Now, right now, all of that testing is manual. There is an issue, and we'll link to it in the show notes, for getting some automated accessibility tests built into Drupal core so that we can actually make sure that certain things just get kind of covered by that. But right now, the people that would do an accessibility review, like accessibility maintainers, they would jump in and do some manual tests. And there's actually a great how to conduct an accessibility audit documentation page within the Drupal documentation. We'll link to that in the show notes as well. It kind of runs you through a set of tools that you can use. A lot of those tools are using something known as Axe Core on the back end of it. And it's basically a superset of accessibility tests. So if you look at a product like, say, Site Improve, it runs that set of accessibility tests and then gives you back reports that you're able to try to make your site compliant. In a particular client that I worked with in the last 2 years, Washington County, Oregon, they had Site Improve. We're running modern Drupal. We did basically the deep audit with Site Improve and then worked to keep our score at 100% for WCAG 2.1 AA. And I would say that, interestingly enough, you can get the platform to 100%. It took us probably about 6 months of, kind of tweaking things. And it was interesting too, because every time we would tweak something and get to 100%, Site Improve would find something new that we're like, oh, but you already scanned our site. Why didn't you see that previously? So even those tools are constantly trying to improve. So they're adding new rules and new ways of testing things. And I would say it was probably, 2 or 3 hours a week for a year to keep that 100% score. And that doesn't even account for all the things your editors can do. Because when we're thinking about editors doing the simple things like putting headers out of order, and that suddenly your page is not, it's not 2.1 compliant because you don't have semantic editors anymore. That's a something for like editorially to be able to jump in and provide some additional support to try to be preventative rather than just doing audits and addressing them going back and forth.
I will say about those tools, one thing I really wish would become part of the spec is like a decorative attribute to add to image tags, because if you have decorative images, you're not supposed to put alt text on it, but that's going to throw off. And I know tools you can mark it. Yeah, you can mark it, but you end up getting flags, and then people look at it and be like, your site's not accessible. It's like, well, no, it actually is, because that's a decorative image. But like a declarative way to be like, this is a decorative image, it should not have an alt tag, would be nice. But
looks like there's two modules right now. One is called Decorative Images and the other one is called Decorative Image Widget.
Yes, and what that does, as far as I'm aware, those both allow you to mark an image as decorative and will not make the alt text required. But when
something is that not what you were asking for?
No, because what will happen is then something will scan the page and be like, hey, these images don't have alt text. That's inaccessible. So what I'm saying is there needs to be like an actual attribute on the image tag that declares it as decorative. So that the
data dash decorative, something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. So tool scanning, now people will just add that to every single image, but that's no different than what people, like, you still need somebody to look at it to see if it truly is decorative or not, because people can just put dummy alt text too.
It's Wait same, a second, Nick. Are you suggesting building your site to comply to the test is not true accessibility?
Of course not. People will do that. But what I mean is having a way to declaratively say, I have reviewed this image, it is decorative, here's the attribute to prove it, so that the tools take that into consideration would be helpful as well. Because that would be helpful.
I believe editorially might do, I know it does something similar with like asking if you wanted like this link to open in an external window. Like, did you want this to be an external link? And you can say, yes, I do, and hide this warning from all other users. I'm not sure if Sally does that, but editorially does. So it might be able to flag things like that as once you see it once, set it for the other admins not to see that specific instance.
I think another interesting aspect here too is that Drupal CMS actually, I believe, has an accessibility tools recipe. So you do have the ability, right? If you're, you know, in this situation where you have to kind of spin up a new site quickly, maybe you could shift to a Drupal CMS based version of your site, apply the accessibility tools recipe and kind of be in a better spot to have the kind of underpinnings that you need to be able to make the shift a little bit easier for you. Josh, would you tend to agree with that assessment, or am I like way off here?
I'm going to agree with it in that it will help move you towards it. The accessibility tools basically enables editorially and a couple other small tweaks that will make the content creation process more likely to catch accessibility issues that editors create. Really, editorially is best about what editors can do. When you're thinking about your entire accessibility plan, you really have to take into account all of your components and your overall front-end theme, because that's going to be your, you know, 80 to 90% of being able to get to a compliance score using something like Site Improve or Monsido or Lighthouse or any of those tools that do the accessibility checks. Using Axe Core as the kind of base for that, the framework. Mm-hmm. I really think, you know, spending the time up front in a project as you're creating your components, testing each of those components for accessibility is, you know, the best way to get to an accessible Drupal site. But it is very theme focused, and you have to have themers working on the project that are very accessibility aware. And your backend devs who are working with the themers to create some of the interactivity and the functionality around things like if you have a search interface, making sure that, you know, your search form is completely accessible. If you have facets or filters built into your search interface, that those all have proper ARIA labels and everything set up. A lot of that is front-end theming, even though there are core Drupal modules that provide some of that functionality and they themselves are pretty darn accessible out of the box. Some of those changes that you make to it in order to reach your brand guidelines end up, you know, having some accessibility impacts that you have to kind of consider. And I would say like any, and this is just for modern Drupal. If I'm looking back at Drupal 7 stuff, if you're still running Drupal 7, you're not going to hit 2.1 AA. It's just not going to happen. There's too many dependencies out there. That would prevent it. One interesting thing about Drupal CMS as it relates to accessibility, I think they're doing a really good job of trying to pick modules that are for the most part accessible on the front end. I think the sheer number of modules that have been picked and the complexity that they add to some of the backend forms, we need to make sure as a community that we're doing some accessibility testing there because that accessibility gateway doesn't apply to Drupal CMS. Drupal CMS is still in move fast and improve, you know, just improve that UI, UX experience. On the front end, I think we're okay. But on the back end, I think a lot of those tools haven't been fully, you know, tested by a real individual with a screen reader as an example. I can tell you right now, like CK Editor, for instance, if your field uses CK Editor, it's not going to hit 2.1 AA. So if you're trying to hit it for your editors as well as the public, I don't think we're even in a spot where that's achievable at the moment. I think we're going to need to be focused on that public content, which is what the ruling is focused on.
Well, so let's dig into that for a second too, because I think that's an important distinction here, right? Like, so yeah, we have backend Drupal like content editor doing stuff, right? Being accessible and being like being usable by those people, but like this ruling, right? Does it simply talk about that front end public facing content, or is the idea here that end to end the whole system should be accessible to everybody?
I think fortunately, it's only focused on what the public can consume. It is not focused on the accessibility of the editor experience. So if you can publish it, the published version is going to be what is covered by this. And there's some exclusions that are out there that I think make it a little bit easier, though not perfect. I think one of the questions sorry, I'm jumping ahead on this one, but one of the questions was on the list was said is, are PDFs covered? Yes. PDFs are absolutely covered, but not if they're, I'm throwing up air quotes here since this is a podcast, not if they're archived content that was created before the date of required compliance. So if you're a 50,000 people sized jurisdiction and you have PDFs on your site right now that are not accessible and they're still on the site after the 2026 deadline, that might be okay if they're in a section of the site where it's clear that it's archived material, that it's not meant to be up to date. But if it's something that's been edited at any time up to after that point, it has to be compliant from that point forward.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I was going to say, this PDF form, air quotes again, form hasn't been touched since like say 2023. Is in its nature it called archived, or does it literally have to be like in a section that is like these are our old documents and are not current?
See, I think it's going to be more of the latter of what you just described. Like when John was talking about earlier, looking up the plats and looking up, oh, hey, this is where the boundary lines are for this really old property. Those documents are absolutely going to qualify as archived. You know, it could be a TIFF scan of an image that got converted into a PDF and it's sitting on an old system. If it's just something to look up for research or record keeping, then it's absolutely going to be exempt. But if it were like, say, hey, you have to fill out this form and then print it and then get it sent in, that type of thing is absolutely going to be required to be compliant. I mean, if you're still relying on PDF forms in 2025 for government services, those forms, you're going to have to actually test them for accessibility because they're actively used and they are not archived content, you know? So I think that's a little bit of a difference there.
And what's the best way? We talked about using editorially for a better Drupal admin experience. What's the best way for folks to update PDFs and spreadsheets and documents that to know that they're accessible or not?
So there are unfortunately limited tools in this area. I know that, for instance, Monsanto does have a PDF accessibility checker, and it will do some basics of looking at a PDF to see if its headings are semantically structured. Because if you create, for instance, if you create a PDF from a semantic website, you know, print the website, turn it into a PDF, your PDF will be accessible. If you create it from a Word document that used table-based layouts and all your heading choices were based on how big the font was and not its semantic meaning, that's not going to be accessible. So you would actually have to go back to the source document, correct its accessibility for the conversion into the PDF. And there aren't great tools for that. There are tools you can use in Word now to say, hey, check this document for accessibility before you create a archival PDF sort of thing. But there aren't great tools for, you know, like scanning a website and saying, oh, okay, in this website, all of these linked documents that are not archived, this is how we get them to accessible. It's another part of, I think, the ruling that's not completely feasible for the 2-year timeline is that addressing all of these documents that have been created by these governments is going to be challenging.
Just as a note to our listeners, Monsanto, for anybody that's looking at it, is now Acquia Optimize. So just if you're looking for Monsanto out there, it's now Acquia Optimize.
There's an opportunity maybe for AI to do something here with these documents and help people get a little like better at making them accessible. There might be a little market here.
Potentially.
It's potential. So we had an episode back, episode 316, where one of the first big shows I think we had on accessibility with the guest, Rain Michaels. And I remember we talked about PDFs then, and her general statement was PDFs are impossible to make accessible. Like, you can do it. They take an extraordinary amount of effort and care. And I think her point was, you should just not use PDFs, just put the content on the page. Now, that being said, there are some nice things about PDFs, which are, it can be nicer to, you can pull it offline, right? You can have a local version of it, or you can email it, and printing. But Drupal has some pretty nice ways of making certain sections of the site more printable than others, so that's something to explore. Mm-hmm. I think you can also have, although this I think probably still takes a lot of effort, you can have an on-demand PDF generator. And this is the question for, this is a really edge case, Josh. If you have a website that allows you to create an on-demand PDF, does that product have to be accessible? Assuming it's from an accessible site, it would be accessible. But how does that work?
I can give you an example where I worked with a team to make it accessible. So I go back to City of Portland a lot because it was a big project, multi-year. One of the things we built there was a council agenda builder. So every time the council would meet, you would have these documents that were created by the bureaus that then would make their way up to elected officials to get approved. And then the council clerk would approve it, and then they would put it on the agenda. We built the entire thing as a set of relationships between some custom entity glue, like agenda item, and content types like agenda and council document and workflows and all these other things. But it all created HTML pages that would then make their way up into a finalized agenda. We created a print review for that agenda, and they would create a council packet that was a PDF So it no longer could change and it would get added to the records retention system. And that PDF was absolutely accessible. But the entire thing creating the PDF was a set of accessible web pages so that we could ensure that the final product was. Now, that was a pretty cool project. I love the fact that the city was willing to take that on and build that. I mean, it replaced the whole paper process for them that saves a lot of money on the creation of a council meeting every week. But that's not necessarily going to be feasible for like somebody who's been using the Granicus agenda management tool as an example, because that relies on using a Word document and there's no requirements on the template. So your council clerk has to become familiar with making that Word document that is their source document super accessible before they create their final document and everything else. So I don't know. I think, you know, stay away from PDF is a great piece of advice. I like the stay away from PDF until you archive it and archive it from whatever the source is that is accessible, and you will get an accessible PDF that you can then put into archive records, which ironically, I mean, those will still be covered going forward. So starting April 2026, that PDF that you created as the archival actually has to be accessible, because anything after that 2026 date, the things that you're putting into those archivals and records retention systems do need to be accessible. They just allowed for the exemption so that they could have this like huge trove of historical documents that that aren't covered.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense. I mean, it would be nice someday. I don't think this is realistic someday to have that retroactive, but the truth is a lot of that data, I mean, this is the archive data, so the source things don't exist. So you'd be recreating something. And then is it really archive at that point if you're recreating a file wholesale to try to correct it? So, I think this is exciting in a lot of respects. It is going to be a monumental undertaking for a lot of organizations or a lot of jurisdictions, but I think it will make the web a better place.
So, Josh, as we get ready to ramp down here a little bit, I'm wondering if I'm an organization, and maybe I'm one of those smaller organizations, right? And I literally am just hearing about this here on this podcast, or one of my constituents has said, hey, have you heard anything about this ruling? Like literally, I just found out about this today, right? Do you have like one or two tips for an organization that hasn't focused on this as to, you know, where, like what their first steps should be to start moving towards compliance?
Yeah, you bet. First thing I would say is prioritize based on impact. So start with your services. If it is something that the public comes in and requests something of your jurisdiction and you give them something back, so something as simple as report a pothole, right? That form, make it accessible. You know, if it's currently, I doubt report a pothole is going to be, you know, fill out a PDF and submit it. It's more likely going to be a web form or something like that. Make sure that that web form is super accessible and that process is clean. So anything that is public facing as a service, make that your priority. I would say do an overall audit of your general look and feel brand. Make sure that you're hitting compliance around things like contrast, just so that you've got a good baseline. So if somebody comes to the site and they see it right off, they're not immediately like, oh, it's a bunch of tiny gray text. You know, that's one of my big red flags, right? If I go to a site and it's like tiny gray text, I'm like, okay, it's inaccessible. Like I can tell you everything else about that application hasn't even looked at accessibility if I start with tiny gray text as kind of the baseline. So take a look at those applications, do a deeper dive on the ones that have the glaring accessibility issues, and begin negotiating with your third-party vendors on compliance of their products. So target services, negotiate with your third-party vendors. And then the third area that I would focus on is get your legislative aspects of your governments, right? So if you have a code or a charter or the thing that defines how your government works, spend some time working on making that accessible, because I think that's going to be key content that you can point people back to and say that you're making a best effort. You know, we've made our law something that you can actually tab through, that you can use a screen reader to read, which, by the way, isn't super easy, because something as simple as, you know, the example I always give is the city code, the ordered list, because it's legislative code, the list order may break from like what an ordered list can even do. So if you're using an ordered list, you probably want to do like an unstyled ordered list, do your nesting, and then like manually put in the AA, AB, AC, AD, because you never know when, you know, DD, DF, maybe we skip, we struck DE from the record, right? And it's no longer part of the law. Yeah. And you didn't want to renumber everything thereafter. So that sort of thing. But take a look at that legal, you know, this is the laws that run this jurisdiction, and try to address that as well. And I don't think that most of these jurisdictions are going to hit the deadline 100%. I think it's going to be some amount of negotiation that happens afterward. I will throw something out, and this is a little bit political, but I'm not going to make it too political. The reality is we don't know how the current administration will enforce this. They could take the stance of it's accessibility, it's for people, it's about equity. They might choose to completely ignore it or not enforce it. Or another possibility that scares me a little bit is that it's aimed at larger jurisdictions first, and larger jurisdictions, larger cities, larger counties, it could be weaponized against cities and states that they choose to go after for not meeting the accessibility ruling. So I think we're in a weird space where we're going to have to wait and see. I'm hoping they ignore it and don't even pay attention to it because they're so focused on other things. But we'll see what actually ends up happening there.
So we talked about earlier that enforcement really comes down to people and kind of people raising lawsuits, right? So, you know, based on that, I would say that, like, me, you know, the governmental enforcement of this, right, is really based on people raising the issue in court, and then the courts kind of levying those penalties and forcing people to make changes. Like, is that still accurate in your mind?
I do think that's the way we'll end up getting enforced. A little bit of funding being withheld, and a little bit of lawsuits pushing for change. And any one of those lawsuits, you know, there will be an increasing body of work that shows how hard it is for governments to meet certain aspects of this compliance, and it'll kind of shape the direction that goes.
And one last point on the tips section, right? Like, I would imagine that you would suggest if there is a service or a platform that a municipality could move to that would be accessible and resolve a large portion of their migration journey, like, that might be something that they should heavily consider. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think, you know, get an audit done so you know what your risk is, so you know how big your lift is. And then, you know, I think this is one of the areas where truly Drupal shines, right? Mm-hmm. Drupal is a platform you can make accessible, even if it's not inherently accessible by default. I mean, the core is, but like, as soon as you get an agency in building out a theme, things can go sideways. But do the audit, build with an accessibility first mindset whenever you're building that new site. But yeah, it would be great if this spurred a mass migration to Drupal, because it's easier to make Drupal accessible. I think the reality is it's going to be a mix. There will probably be other products that come out in the near future that will, you know, kind of challenge that space for government and manage services and manage hosting. Site templates could be part of this. Maybe we get more like local gov and GovCMS and some of the products that exist for, like, say, Canada and Australia and the UK right now, where they have a really good framework that they can do over and over and over again for Drupal sites. Maybe more states and local governments get into that space and start using a good starting point that they can build off of. We'll see.
Just made me think of last week's Drupal Forge, and I believe they have the demo, the governor, which I think
governor. Yeah,
That's I think aimed towards government, and
it's specifically aimed towards federal government because basically it's an implementation of the U.S. Digital Service Design System. But yeah, it's the implementation of specifically federal government websites and that design system. Yep. A lot of local governments could use that design system, but it's not quite the same as like say LocalGov out of the UK, where it's a design system built for local UK governments to reuse, or GovCMS, which is the same thing for Australia, where it's really focused on local governments. It's like the equivalent of our cities and counties, that sort of thing.
There's something that has cropped up over the last few years, and I've had clients ask me again and again, and I suspect we're going to see a lot of this in the coming years as the easy solution to accessibility, which is the nice little JavaScript widget in the bottom right-hand corner of your website that you can click to make the site accessible. Can you share your thoughts on these products and what should people consider when looking at them?
I mean, it's the website functional equivalent of taking off your shoes at the airport. It is theater. It's probably not going to fix much of anything to have a JS widget on your site to quote unquote make it accessible. Those JavaScript widgets can give you a dark mode. They can increase your font size so you've got better font size. They might be able to give you a grayscale version of the site that wipes out some of your contrast issues for 2.1. They will not fix any of your keyboard traps. They will not be able to fix any of your semantic heading ordering or anything like that. And there have been some studies on like whether or not folks that are using a keyboard can easily find those JavaScript widgets to use. So I think they're theater. I think you need to be hitting the accessibility requirements with your design. And then most of the things that little widget would be able to help you with, you're covered on. You know, if you've got your font sizing correct and your contrast correct and those types of things, that's what it does best in terms of being able to override your site styles and quote unquote make them more accessible.
Josh, I just want to clarify there, right? These widgets, right? You're saying they won't fix some of the inherent structural problems with your code, which is understandable, right? A JS is not going to be able to update or change your code. But are you saying they also don't help if your code is bad at helping the individual get to those pieces of your site?
They don't, no. I mean, they can provide tools that likely the person accessing the website have already found an accommodation that works for them. Like I know if I'm using my browser, I can set it so that it's going to do a high contrast mode and I'm just going to see everything with that high contrast mode and not see other people's designs, their colors, their choices, whatever. So yeah, that JavaScript widget can override that thing for you, which is great for telling your boss that, hey, look, we made it accessible by slapping this on the site, but it didn't fix the underlying problem, which is our font sizes weren't big enough to start with. Mm-hmm. Our click targets weren't big enough to start with. Our semantic structure wasn't what it needs to be. It really doesn't address any of those like fundamental aspects of JavaScript. Of web accessibility. It's trying to apply some changes that, frankly, if you've had to deal with this for a while, you've already been applying these changes to your browser because you have to, right? And that's kind of a baseline that I tend to use is would I have fixed this on my own as somebody who has low vision or color blindness or any of the various accessibility accommodations that I might need to do with my local operating system in my browser.
Speaking of color blindness, the new like recommended color for modules is very hard for me to see. I don't know if you've seen the new module pages, that light like
blue, light blue, yeah,
and gray. And maybe I'll have to send a message to the team because I think that there's an issue already, but I've been struggling with head color.
Have you commented on that issue as somebody who?
I've mentioned it a couple times. I feel like that's a
key a key piece of data, right? If there's a person that is, you know, actively affected, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Josh, we appreciate your time. We appreciate you bringing this topic to us and discussing it so vigorously.
It's wonky, but it was fun.
Yeah. Appreciate your suggestions and advice. Thanks.
All right. If you have questions or feedback, you can reach out to Talking Drupal on social media with the handle Talking Drupal or by email with show@talkingdrupal.com. You can connect with our hosts and other listeners on Drupal Slack in the Talking Drupal channel.
Just like MidCamp did in this episode, you can promote your Drupal community event on Talking Drupal. Learn more at talkingdrupal.com/TD promo.
Get the Talking Drupal newsletter to learn more about our guest host show news, upcoming shows, and much more. You can sign up for the newsletter at talkingdrupal.com/newsletter.
And thank you, patrons, for supporting Talking Drupal. Your support is greatly appreciated. You can learn more about becoming a patron at talkingdrupal.com and clicking the Become a Patron button in the sidebar. All right, everyone. Josh, if folks wanted to get a hold of you, talk about accessibility, maybe hire you to provide your expertise to their municipality or their project, how could they go about doing that?
Yeah, so I'm Josh Awami on Drupal.org, Drupal Slack, even on LinkedIn. JoshAwami.com is my blog, and there will be a companion blog post to this this topic that I'll share for the show notes. It'll be publishing around the same time as this goes live.
Awesome. Kathy Beck, what about you?
You can find me kbeck303 at socials or kbeck@oomphinc.com.
Awesome. Nick?
You can find me pretty much everywhere at NixVan, NICXVAN.
And I'm John Picozzi. You can find me personally at picozzi.com or on the social media and drupal.org at John Picozzi. You can also find out about EPAM at epam.com.
And if you've enjoyed listening, we've enjoyed talking. See you guys next week.
Thanks a lot, everyone.
Bye.